imagine them in a school bus or in a classroom with their friends playing soccer in a field when the school day ends. Then I imagine the hospitals where the survivors go, their tiny bodies burnt and wrapped in gauze from head to toe. Each day I wake up and wonder if this might be the time when those who hold the purse strings have had enough of the war crimes. Then instead I'm hearing of the latest ones who have died in the unrelenting slaughter of Israel's kindercide. Say there are 35 kids in Gaza being killed.
Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. If you've just tuned in, I'm talking today with John Helmer. John's a journalist and author. He spent decades living in and reporting from Russia. He's the principal behind the web news site Dances with Bears and has, as well as serving as advisor to governments at the highest levels, too, been a professor of political science, sociology, and journalism. Among his many book titles are The Man Who Knew Too Much About Russia, The Lie That Shot Down MH17, and the lately released autobiography, Dunce Upon a Time, A Life of Mistakes, and most poignantly, Skripal in Prison, the first and perhaps only book to follow the Skripal saga that we're discussing today from its beginnings. His most recent article at Dances with Bears on the subject isn't British chemical warfare agent reveals Novichok was not detected in Don Sturgis and Charles Rowley at first and second try, but there was cocaine because he's written more in the meantime. Okay, John, so now here we are. We're in the apartment. Now, I've seen a report from Tim Norman, who's been following this over there in Britain. UK column is where a lot of Tim's stuff appears, is Timtron 2020 on X. And he says that the inquiry has been trying to say and has said that neither Dawn Sturgis nor her boyfriend Charlie Crowley were drugs addicts, but they were drugs users. Now, you before the break were saying that the police went to their apartment and found it was littered with drug paraphernalia for injectable drugs and stuff that would suggest that that's not the case. Why would the court think that that was what the case was, and why would that be significant?
I've lost you a bit there. I know what Tim has been writing. I know, and I can just explain to listeners, that the police, the Wiltshire County Police, described Dawn Sturgis as a drug addict in their initial investigations, and they were correct. They've since apologized during the hearing that they were mistaken. That apology is false. The fact is that the pre-mortem and post-mortem toxicology evidence shows that Dawn Sturgis had consumed not only cocaine, but fentanyl. Now, you mix cocaine and fentanyl, each one of them is a potentially lethal cocktail when mixed with alcohol. And we now know that the toxicological testing of Dawn Sturgis's blood showed the evidence that she'd consumed cocaine and fentanyl. So that doesn't make a drug addict. It does make a potentially lethal cocktail of drugs, which could have caused cardiac arrest, which is what the ambulance men arriving at the scene saw and dealt with. It was the ambulance men who looked for evidence of drugs that might have triggered her collapse, Dawn Sturgis's collapse. They couldn't have seen a Novichok bottle because it wasn't there. It was introduced there 11 days later. So what fentanyl means in Dawn Sturgis's blood is that the police investigating at the time were correct. There had been a spate of fentanyl overdoses in that area of Wiltshire, and they had reason to suspect that one of the dealers had been at a party the night before the collapse. We can go into detail after detail about this, but this is finally coming out that Dawn Sturgis's blood contained cocaine and fentanyl. Now, to suggest anything else about her, then goes to her boyfriend, Charlie Rowley. Rowley told an ambulance man, who has told the public inquiry, that she was alcoholic. There's no doubt that she had an alcohol problem. Had she been taking it the night before? We don't know yet. But what we now know is that she had been taking this other stuff with which Rowley didn't want to admit. Rowley himself is on prescription methadone, the heroin substitute for people to protect them from heroin, direct heroin usage and heroin overdose. When Dawn Sturgis, let's say, potential brain dead, but barely able to breathe and with a very weak heartbeat, was put in the ambulance to revive her, resuscitate her, and take her to the emergency ward at Salisbury District Hospital a few minutes away, the ambulance man asked Rowley, would you like to come in, accompany your girlfriend, your partner, your companion, your lover, to hospital? He said no. And what Rowley, we now know, did was go up the street with his mates to collect methadone and have a hit. That's what Rowley did. And that was hours before Rowley called the ambulance back because he was having an episode subsequently diagnosed as Novichok-related. What we also now know from the hearing is that when the Salisbury Hospital, using Porton Down sophisticated machinery and technology, analyzed their blood, they couldn't find Novichok. They couldn't find an organophosphate corresponding to the Novichok, which had been announced for the Skripals 12 weeks earlier. So when they couldn't find it, they asked Porton Down what to do. We now know the exchange of emails and telephone calls that followed. And Porton Down took over the management of Dawn Sturgis's failing body in the intensive care unit of Salisbury Hospital. So they then, the hospital doctors, sent Dawn Sturgis's blood to a Birmingham toxicology laboratory. And in that laboratory, far away, independent of the Salisbury Hospital, the machine did not identify anything, an organophosphate, a poison, that's corresponding to or being named as Novichok. So that was the first try in Salisbury using Salisbury Hospital, using a Porton Down machine. Second try, Birmingham Toxicology Lab using a Porton Down machine. First and second tries failed to prove what the government says was happening. So what happens next? At the third try, blood and urine go to Porton Down, the chemical warfare lab, and it's the source of the allegation that it was Novichok which was the toxic agent that felled Dawn Sturgis and Charles Rowley. It's Porton Down which then is the site in which the story's created. I didn't know a great deal about that when the book was being written. We know a great deal more now this week after the Porton Down agent, if given a special code name FT49 to protect his name, though his name is likely to have been advertised by himself in academic publications he's circulated since the event. What we now know is that Porton Down ordered the finding. Now, we also know that from a highly censored, redacted excerpt of report that Porton Down put in the inquiry record, that they couldn't find the Novichok they were looking for on several runs of their tests, first of the blood and then of later post-mortem tissues. And finally, if this doesn't shock you, it certainly continues to shock me, Porton Down adds the tiniest of small print qualifier to say that in the testing of Dawn Sturgis's post-mortem after-death tissue samples, they ran tests which they'd never run before, and that the results were what they were calling developmental. That's government speak for maybe false.
Well, and FT49 of Porton Down, I believe he was the author, or she, of the human sponge hypotheses as well, that explains.
No doubt the man.
And is he then the author of that hypothesis about the human sponge? And do you know?
I can tell you that according to my sources in Britain, the man who's identified as FT49 has published at least two, maybe three academic publications with others on this episode. I'm not permitted to say what his name is or what the name is of the Porton Down expert in those publications, because Judge Hughes has issued a blanket order. You're not pardon me, that applies at least in England, but probably not in the free state of Canada or in the free state of the United States of America. You're not allowed
don't get
to
me
name
started.
Him. Not allowed to name him. So we, but what we can say with reasonable confidence on what he said and what the transcript is of what he said and what the exhibits of evidence that are in the record say, we know that they had great trouble finding the match for the Novichok, which they themselves had, in order to identify that what they had called Novichok and what they found in the blood and urine of Rowley and Sturgis were the same. What we also know from the United States, from Korea, from Iran, from all over the place, is that it wasn't the Russians who alone had possession of this Novichok. The South Koreans synthesized it, the Iranians synthesized it, and certainly the American Poisons Lab. I think it's called the Edgewood Arsenal. I've forgotten the exact name. We're all capable and all did, in fact, report publicly that they had created a Novichok before all these events. So I'm sorry to have to draw everybody's attention to the small print, but when you look at the small print, you're basically seeing the British government coming up with a poison that they can't, that nobody sees until 11 days after the Dawn Sturgis is taken ill. We find that then they can't find a clear identifying evidence in blood and urine and tissue samples identifying a Novichok. But by then, the British government was ordering it publicly said. So the tests have come years after the announcement of the allegation, and there isn't anybody, not Judge Hughes, not Pottle, O'Connor, and Whitelaw, the lawyers purportedly questioning witnesses, none of them detect this contradiction. None of them detect this fabrication. None of them ask questions except leading questions. So the entire public hearing is a questioning by these lawyers and the judge to confirm the narrative, the official narrative, that a Russian Novichok did all this damage. And one of those lawyers, a woman called Emily Pottle, was appointed by Hughes a couple of years back to represent the Russians at the hearing. Well, Pottle has never asked a question representing the Russians. She's turned from defense lawyer, you might say, into state prosecutor. That's nonsense.
Yeah, well, it's definitely a conflict. So, okay, John, I mean, I want to move on. The inquiry is ongoing. There's going to be more. But one question before we leave it, because I want to talk about what you said about the Skripals being intubated and drugged into comas before the arrival of the OPCW. But before we leave the Skripal or the Sturgis inquiry, does the Stephen Cockcroft, Dr. Stephen Cockcroft, does his testimony about the Skripals waking up out when they the halts or the pause on the sedation was ordered by one of his fellow doctors, all of a sudden Julius Skripal woke up, to his surprise and delight, and this is what got him into so much trouble. But does Stephen Cockcroft's testimony, does that blow it all out of the water as far as the Skripal inquiry goes, if it proves that there was no Novichok to begin with?
Not quite, but if you read Cockcroft's further testimony, he very interestingly says he no longer works at Salisbury District Hospital. He works elsewhere in the Salisbury area. What he says is that he understood that the Skripals had been attacked with a poison, but he believed it was a spray consisting of something he calls car fentanyl, C-A-R, fentanyl, one word. He said, as an anesthesiologist, he knows a great deal about fentanyl because he uses it professionally in anesthesiology operations, okay? Carfentanil, he described, as lethal off the scale compared to fentanyl, okay? What Cockcroft says on the stand, so to speak, is that he doesn't doubt there was a murder attempt against the Skripals, an assassination attempt, if you will, but that he implies it wasn't a so-called Russian Novichok. It was something he called carfentanil. Implied in what Cockcroft said was that the poison was delivered at the bench in Town Square of Salisbury, so that the Yulia and Sergei Skripal collapsed almost minutes after they had been attacked. Now, the implication of that is that it couldn't have been Russians who did it. It was somebody else. Now, Cockcroft doesn't go into that. The lawyers never ask about that. But let's make it clear what's meant. If it was carfentanil and it was sprayed at the bench, it was a British government attack on these people, the Skripals. And that leads us in an entirely different and speculative direction. But enough has been said in this hearing to show that there is an entirely alternative explanation for what happened and an entirely alternative explanation for why. And so the big lie is exposed as leading to something else that nobody wants to touch.
Well, why does why does Cockcroft's assertion that it was carfentanil, why does that necessitate that it's the British government attempt and not a third Russian that was present
in the answer to that is easy. There's CCTV focused on the bench. We've seen some pictures of it, of the Skripals immediately after their collapse. So there are CCTV pictures of them on the bench prior to that, immediately before their collapse. There are witnesses, physical witnesses, who saw them on the bench, let's call it pre-episode and post-episode.
Yeah, they're feeding the ducks or something. Right?
Well, that happens quite a few minutes before. The point is that there's no evidence that any of the known Russian agents came near them at the bench. No evidence at all.
And of course, that CCTV camera footage is being presented.
Secret.
Well, Boris Johnson must have seen it, though, because on March 17th, 2018, this is, you know, just a week and a half or something after the event, he was confident and said publicly that Russia was responsible. So what, had he seen the pictures?
I would guess, and I stand corrected if listeners remember more from the book than I can remember, or from the subsequent disclosures. Johnson, who was the ambitious foreign secretary aiming to overthrow May as prime minister, to act like the man who's tough enough to be prime minister in a way that Theresa May wasn't, Johnson said that he had got his information from Porton Dunne, from the Defence Science and Technology Lab, DSTL, part of the Ministry of Defence of Great Britain, which is their chemical warfare lab and has been since World War One time. What Johnson said was his source was the Ministry of Defence on the spot at the chemical warfare lab. What he'd seen in terms of CCTV of the bench, I don't know. I don't believe that was the basis for his accusing the Russians of bringing Novichok into the country and using it against the Skripals. That came from Porton Down.
And Porton but he Down, does. But the foreign minister Johnson does kind of tip his hand. He reveals that this is what the British government is interested in, putting this label onto the Russians, because there's other things going on right now in the international sphere where it's very much in their interest to put as much pressure as they can. We didn't get to the OPCW, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, when they were and by the way, Fort Detrick, I believe, is the American counterpart.
Yes,
Porton Down, but they changed the name. I'm not sure what it's called now, but that's traditionally what it was. But now, what's the significance, John, and we're running out of time, the OPCW, they pay a visit to the Skripals while they're intubated and in this artificial coma. What is the purpose of their visit, and why is the British government apparently, or whoever's putting them into this coma, why are they so interested that the Skripals appear as if they are incapacitated and unable to speak?
Well, the Organization for Prevention of Chemical Weapons, the OPCW, based in The Hague, is the international agency which, until this event, pardon me, was the international agency to which a member state, Great Britain, could apply if they believed that a chemical warfare incident or biological war weapon had been used. So the standard practice internationally by treaty that set up and runs the OPCW enables one member to ask for expert technical assessment by OPCW specialists. And that was also used to fabricate the allegation of chemical warfare attacks by the Syrian government in Syria, and subsequently debunked. But in this particular case, what the British did was to summon the OPCW with the expectation the OPCW would produce a report that that ratified and seemed to substantiate that a Russian Novichok had been used. In fact, the OPCW report on Skripal, and you'll find that in the book Skripal in Prison, failed to name the toxic drug which they claimed to have uncovered. Why they didn't name it when it was openly a part of the British government's narrative, why they didn't provide the chemical formula when the Novichok formula was a public one, why they didn't identify the crime or the technology or the method of the MO of the crime when that was what they were asked to substantiate, goes back to the politics of OPCW, which have now been ruined. That agency no longer provides information that was gathered on behalf of the British to the Russian delegation or the Iranian delegation or the Chinese delegation at OPCW. What this event did was to destroy the international credibility of OPCW and its internal processes for sharing allegations, evidence, substantiation, and so on. So OPCW was used. It didn't quite do the trick for the British, but nobody noticed the sleight of hand in the words. And they were brought back to deal with the sampling of blood and tissues of poor Dawn Sturgis. and they again refused to identify the chemical formula, and so on. In fact, OPCW was present when the autopsy on Dawn Sturgis was conducted as a, quote, international independent witness. So summing it up, OPCW is a witness, all right, but not independent. It was there as a stooge for the British official narrative, and that has ended all possibility that OPCW, having discredited itself in Syria on behalf of the US and the British, then discredited itself with the British in, in Salisbury. By the time Alexei Navalny arrives in Germany with the allegation, the OPCW is totally discredited.
And well, we've talked about it now. Well, we've talked about Navalny before, too, and it all paints a picture. Syria, Navalny, the Skripal poisoning, and Dawn Sturgis as well, all focusing on rabble-rousing for war against Russia. We don't have more time today, John, to go into that. The Sturgis inquiry, you can go. There's a live, again, in scare quotes, coverage of it. It's live streamed at youtube.com/@Dawn Sturgis Inquiry, spelt in the English way, I-N-Q-U-I-R-Y. John, you've been very prolific as usual, and you're following this case and you're on the case, and it's a very important case, whether people realize it or not. johnhelmer.net. You can find Dances with Bears there and John's work. Thanks again, as always, John, for coming on. And as always, we've got more topic than time, but maybe we can cover this further the next time.
Thank you, Chris. Yes, we'll cover the topic insofar as it leads to the bigger issues that Canadian and North American listeners need to understand. That's how the big lie makes a big war and how we're at the point we are now. That's why it's worth looking at the small print of the big lie.
And this and other things, too. That's all I got time for today. Until the next time. Thanks, John.
Everything is burning as I watch the video. She crawls out of the ruins, venturing to go out in search of water, the final human need. Although the consequences are almost guaranteed as she goes out in the open beneath the killer drones, which aims their sights on her, then shred her to the bones, then waits for any people who might be fool enough to try, come to fetch her body beneath the smoke-filled sky. 2 million people behind the ghetto wall wait for 2-ton bombs to fall, to crush and burn the schools and tents where your whole extended family went. Scores more murdered with each passing day, with so many more on the edge of being taken away. Surrounded by tanks that fire at will, and the rest of the world stands by still. Completely surrounded with no food getting in. Ghost-like faces, impossibly thin. Kids that look like babies, babies born. Thirsty, starving, and forlorn. Then being taken to who knows where. The elderly, the children, the wounded in chairs. With donkey carts and wagons south on cue, as the drones above the rubble ordered them to do. General's plan, which means kill all the kids that you possibly can. Anyone moving, soldiers take aim. Who they are doesn't matter, they're all the same. Make no distinctions, orders decree. Killing them all is just how it must be. And right now in New Jersey, you can buy shares in the resort Jared Kushner.